8 days ago, we had our Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols, and at the end of the service, I was taken to task by a member of the congregation. I don't mind that at all. Please feel free to take me to task over anything. It just gives me another opportunity to point out where I'm right and you're wrong. But it was concerning an article that I'd written in the latest church magazine, and there are copies around. They will become valuable after this morning's sermon. It was concerning an article I'd written, suggesting that, and this person thought that it had been directed in a way that would be taken personally both by them and by many readers. My argument in a nutshell was that the church had allowed secular society to rebrand Christmas on its own terms, even to the extent that we have allowed secular society to redefine what it means to go to church at Christmas. The offending paragraph was this, describing how secular society imagines people attending church. Usually at midnight on Christmas Eve, preferably in a semi-drunken stupor, or else tag along to the 11 a.m. family service on Christmas Day, where you can be sure the minister will be on top form, lots of laughs, a few favourite carols, and a gentle reminder to be nice to one another, if only for the day. And well, I'm hoist to my own petard. We've had a few laughs. One hopes the minister is on top form. We've had a few favourite carols, and I'm probably going to tell you to be nice to each other just for today. But there is a sense in which that's how Christmas has been dumbed down as far as the wider society is concerned. That's the Christmas message. Christmas is no more than that. Well, sometimes one's rhetoric does run away from oneself, but having reread the paragraph, I actually stick by every word. It's my belief that the church needs to reclaim Christmas for itself by finding the courage to restate what is at the heart of the Christmas story, to rekindle in the hearts and minds of those who are prepared to listen what is tantamount to a vision of glory, akin to the word picture so vividly painted for us in the first chapter of John's Gospel. You see, when we come to Christmas, we have to make a decision. And that decision concerns how do we respond to the claim that in Jesus, God takes on human form. That's the claim. How do we respond? We can't skirt around it, treat it as if it isn't there. We have to respond. I've always been impressed by these words of C.S. Lewis. Lewis wrote this, "I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about Jesus. That is, I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the thoughts of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic at the level of a man who says he is a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman, or something worse. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to." That's the problem. He did not intend us to conclude that he was a great moral teacher. Therefore, we have no right to subvert the message in that direction. Today is not about morality. It's not about a way to live. It's about a response to a claim that one who was born all those years ago was God in human form. If we want to take seriously the Christmas story, we have to do so in accordance with how it describes itself. The incarnation is not a literary device, whether divinely inspired or not, to persuade us to live our lives in a particular way. The Christmas story is not a gathering up of pious platitudes and wrapping them around a tale of derring do, such that they might have an immediate appeal to each and all of us alike. Because as with any morality tale, sooner or later, it finds itself falling short. Because without the incarnation, without a belief that this one who was born is God, without the incarnation, Christianity isn't even a very good story. And most sadly, it means little to nothing. Be nice to one another is not a message that can give my life meaning. It cannot assure me of love beyond brokenness. It cannot break open the dark doors of death with any key of hope. Because that's what's claimed on behalf of the incarnation. The incarnation claims that by believing the baby born at Bethlehem was God in human form, gives your life a meaning it would not otherwise have. It will assure us of love beyond any form of brokenness, and death's doors will be broken open. And we can hope beyond this life. And so the invitation to each of us this Christmas is to approach it from a different direction. To have a sense of Christmas as understood from God's point of view. To ask ourselves, why would God bother? Surely God's intention was and is altogether more profound, more significant, more all-embracing than merely to remind us to be good to each other. There has to be more to it than that. Someone sums it up thus: the incarnation took all that properly belongs to our humanity and delivered it back to us, redeemed. All of our inclinations and appetites and capacities and yearnings are purified and gathered up and glorified by Christ. He did not come to thin out human life. He came to set it free. All the dancing and feasting and processing and singing and building and sculpting and baking and merrymaking that belonged to us and that were stolen away into the service of false gods are returned to us in the gospel. He didn't come to thin out life, to tell us we can't do what others do, but rather to tell us we do it because of who he was and is. I'm not sure about building and sculpting, but I've no doubt that for all of us today there will be varying degrees of dancing and feasting, singing, baking and merrymaking, to say nothing of eating and drinking. And we do know it, and we do it knowing God is approving of it, because that is what Christmas really does mean to God. It was God who designed Christmas in this way. Because I've no doubt that the stable at Bethlehem on that first morning after Jesus was born was itself full of people dancing and feasting and singing and baking and merrymaking and eating and drinking. Because I've no doubt that the birth of a baby is the ideal means by which strangers become friends. I can imagine that even though this family had been made to live out in the stable because there was no room in the inn, the moment the word got out that a baby had been born in the stable, everybody in the inn was out there. I would imagine there was a lot of wetting the baby's head went on that first morning in Bethlehem. I imagine it was a really happy place to be. And people who otherwise would have been strangers were made friends precisely because they could unite around the common humanity that is the birth of a baby. So why shouldn't we? But let's do it because we do it in response to God's being born amongst us in Christ, not because we are told to do it by advertisers and others. Whose tune do we dance to at Christmas? It's all too easy to dance to another tune. And then we have to remember that Christmas isn't over when the last person leaves, when the last carol has been sung, when the last mince pie has been eaten, when the last drink has been drunk. We may think it's all over, but for God it's just beginning. The vision of glory that lit up the night sky all those years ago is radiating down the years, and we, even we, can glimpse something of that same glory. If only we are prepared to open our eyes to see it. The article I referred to in the Church magazine was targeted at a targeted response at the advertisers. And of course, the John Lewis advert never fails to send a shiver down one's spine. But I, for one, was not prepared to laugh off the blasphemy that sees Jesus supplanted by a sausage roll. Because if that's the state that we've reached in terms of our appreciation of Christmas, then the church is failing itself badly in its presentation of the truth of the gospel. In the end, the incarnation is its own advertisement. The Word became flesh and dwelt among us. How do we respond?